IsraelSin.com. I'm not sure many of you are aware of this, but the founder of this college, Alma, is just recently become a member, an MK for Yesh Atid. So, I'm sorry?
That is no recommendation. We're already starting. We're
not going.
No, she's...
5 minutes into the class.
I at least...
Some of us are proud of her.
I at least have some... Knowing good very closely, I have some high hopes for education here, but we'll see what politics does. But she's a good, very, very solid lady and a great scholar and an educator. And we are going to start this five sessions. You saw the different sessions, right? And you saw that I designated the fifth one for your choice, actually. Because it was not because I didn't have a topic to talk about, but rather because I remember from our previous talks that you came up with so many stories that Zohar, we need to find some time to talk about this, and we need to find time to talk about that. So I said, you know what, let's designate 2 hours as the fifth and last session for you to think about if there are certain things that come up either because of the lectures or as an addition topic. Let's say that on the third session, if you can tell me, give me some ideas where we want to go, and I will prepare our fifth session for us. Today's session, I chose to touch a very light, insignificant issue between good, bad, and evil in Jewish thought. And I gave it an additional title, which is Who Makes the Hole in the Donut? And you'll understand why I called it in such a way. And immediately by looking at the title, you should already have a question. Why did I insert there between good and bad and evil rather than between good and evil, which is usually the more classic way of dealing with the subject, right? Between good and evil. Franz Rosenzweig's definition of good versus evil. The works on post-Holocaust theology between good and evil. I mean, you have good and evil. I don't even need to talk to you about dualistic theologies that render the Christ antichrist. There is the quintessential force of good versus the quintessential force of evil. And here I am inserting an intermediary term that I call bad. And I will try to show you today that I actually believe that it's a profound term, not to be taken lightly and definitely not to be swallowed or overshadowed by this abstract term evil. And I will make the distinction between the two.
Good people could be bad.
we'll see. I agree with you, but we'll unpack this. And the way I would like us to do this is by actually navigating through a number of verses, and those of you who studied with me know that we take a certain verse and then we start unpacking it and showing some of the great paradoxes that seem to stem from it, and we'll try to tackle it both from a theological standpoint, a philosophical standpoint. We won't touch religion. Those of you who remember my big lecture to you about the difference between philosophy, theology, and religion, we won't touch religious discourse here because this is not the point of the discussion. The point of the discussion here is to tackle the concepts from a philosophical and theological standpoints. And actually we'll start right from the beginning, no pun intended actually, because we'll start with Genesis chapter A. And I would like to take us there to the last verse of chapter 1. You all have the... Yeah, I do. No, please. There you go. You have one, right? Anybody missing? Anyone missing? All right. I would like to start us with the last verse of chapter 1, which is Genesis 1, verse 31. I assume that everybody here knows the Genesis chapter 1, right? The creation story, right? God created right? So we know that God creates the world. And guys, of course, we're talking here, this is Alma, this is me, we're talking here about a Jewish narrative. There's no absolute truth here. I'm not treating this as an event that happened at a certain junction in space and time. We're dealing with a story here, but a story with profound ramifications and insights, which I would like to unpack with you. And the narrative here discusses the creation of the world, where on at the end of each day, with the exception of the second one, then to be compensated by the third one, God renders each day good. God looks back at each day and says, lo and behold, it was good, and moves on to the second day, looks at it, doesn't bless it, moves to the third day, blesses it twice, and then fourth, fifth, and sixth. You all know what I'm talking about, right? And then at the end of creation, after Adam and Eve are created, which again we need to be accurate here, Adam is not man, but a bigender entity that is then differentiated into male and female. This is not the point of our discussion here, but I just want to make it very clear. God looks at everything that God saw. And now let's look at verse 31 and see what it says. And God saw everything that God had made. I changed the word he to God, by the way. And God saw everything that God had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, vayi erev, vayi boker, yom ha-shishi. The sixth day, okay? What can you tell me about this verse? What does it actually say? No trick question here.
He was very pleased with himself.
Who was? God was very pleased with?
Himself.
Well, with his creation.
Well, yes. Okay?
All that he achieved. With all that he had created,
all that he had accomplished, all that he had achieved. Now, guys, if we look at this verse, and by the way, this is the most definite, most absolute verse in the entire Torah. God, who is all-powerful, omnipotent, omniscient, all-knowing, whatever you can call it, a perfect being, looks at everything that God did, everything. A perfect being looks at all of creation and renders it not good, very good. He says good on all other days. On this one, he says, "Hine tov me'od." All right? So let's start with an absolute statement that says the supreme authority looks at the entirety of its authorship, what he had authored, creation, and renders it very, very good. You can't do better than that, pretty much. So the seal of approval on the creation story starts us with very good. My friends, the rabbis already here had a profound problem. Because they live here on earth, and they look around them and they say that there's a lot of shit happening. How do we reconcile this with what we see here? So you won't be surprised probably to hear that in the Talmud it already said Tov means Tov, and Me'od means bad. Oh, yes. Yes. Why? Because if you deal with Torah and you perceive it as the living word of God, which by definition is infallible, it means that if something looks to you erroneous or contradictory, it means you don't understand it correctly, not that there is a problem with the author. And that's basically the whole backbone of hermeneutics and exegesis. You now start to maneuver around something that looks on the text as problematic, and you try to work around, but that's not where we're going to go. I actually treat this as very good. I don't go with the rabbis on this one. Good means good, and very means, lo and behold, very. So when it says, and God looked at all that God had made and rendered it very good, I take it at face value. This is a very good creation. Okay? So now let's move on to the ninth verse of the second chapter. And all, I should have said all hell breaks loose, but in this case, it's all Garden of Eden breaks loose. And out of the ground made the Lord God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life also in the midst of the garden. And guys, now don't talk to me as 21st century Jews who know this book by heart. Read it as if the only text you've ever read before was Genesis chapter 1. And tell me what you read here. And in the midst of the garden, right? The tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge. Guys, I just showed you that the whole of creation is very good.
Yeah, so where does evil come from?
Not just what, no. You already said where does evil come from. You already know what evil means. You already assume that it's the opposite of good. You already brought a lot of assumptions into the discussion, which we have absolutely nothing to work with based on chapter 1 in Genesis.
I didn't make the tree either.
Ah, wait.
From very good,
yeah.
Verse 31,
yeah.
To verse 9, we lose the very.
Okay.
Because at this point, we're going into an evil world.
Ah, so you're saying that between 131 to 2:9, there's already some sort of a decline. Okay, very, very interesting.
This is when first aware of good and evil.
Okay, let's see. First of all, what we read in between is the Garden of Eden. It gives us a description of the Garden of Eden. It has four rivers, and they're differentiated into four parts, and they're made of gold, and bdolach, and crystal, and blah, blah, blah. It looks like a very nice place. It also describes to us, and in the beginning there are two types of trees, among many other trees. One of them is the tree of life, with which we have little problem. And then there is a tree of... Before that what? Before what? Nothing happened yet. Guys, they haven't eaten anything yet. It's just there. It's the designation of the tree. They haven't touched it. You know, there's a joke that says about the story of the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve eating the fruit, the apple, right? The apple is a much later rendition in Christian literature. It has nothing to do with the Torah. In the Torah, it's a fig. In the Talmud, it's a fig. Never mind. But there's a joke about that if Adam and Eve were Chinese, we wouldn't be in this predicament that we're in history, because they would have eaten the snake. We have a very, very different story there. But that's not our case. Our case is that what we're facing right now is a reality in which there is a description of a tree, okay, that seems to render some sort of a differentiation between good and something else. The fact that it's called Ra, and by the way, I'll try to show you that Ra should be translated as bad, not evil, and I'll talk about it later. But there's a differentiation there between one term and another term. And now look at what God says to Adam and Eve about this tree. Bless you. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, "Of every tree of the garden thou may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and something, thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that you eat thereof, thou shalt surely..." Again, what? What? No, my friends, read it based on Genesis number 1. You experience death around you, unfortunately, it's part of life. We have befriended that ridiculous term, death, without, by the way, knowing nothing about it. This is the first Adam and Eve. These are the first creatures on earth. Let me tell you how I think Adam and Eve hear this verse. "And the Lord God commanded the man," or commanded Adam, and saying, "Of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and toot, you shall not eat, because the day you eat from it, you shall surely toot." Adam has no knowledge of bad, and Adam has no knowledge of death.
Does he have knowledge of good?
So now we're asking a very, very different question. Because now your question puts bad, I just said he has no knowledge, and you say, okay, so very nice, but does he have a knowledge of good? And here we move our discussion to a very, very different level. And for that, I want to give you a parable, which is the second title of this lecture. I come to you, and I say to you, I want you to make a donut. You bring the dough, you bring the eggs, you bring the flour, you bring the salt, the sugar, the oil, I'll bring the whole. Don't laugh. Wait, it's going to get very, very complicated in a minute. I bring the whole in the dough. So you laugh at me. So what are you talking about? It's ridiculous. You're not doing anything. I'll say, wait, before you mock me, let me tell you that part and parcel of the definition of a donut and the perception of a donut is the hole in the middle. And if it would not...
And the polo mint.
And?
The polo mint.
The what?
The UK, there's a mint.
Oh, okay.
It's just a hole.
Okay.
Like a donut, with a hole in the middle.
Like an asimón. Like there used to be an asimón. The All right, so I'm bringing the hole. Now you say to me, oh, this is ridiculous.
Are you going in the direction of how can you appreciate good without understanding bad?
Not yet.
How can you appreciate beauty without having ugliness?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
What I'm saying is, I'm trying to alter our perception for a second in order to enter this discussion in an intelligent manner. And one of the ways of doing it is to try and challenge what we take utterly for granted. So I now come and tell you that when you look at the donut, and I'm being Platonic in this kind of philosophical approach. What you recognize as donutism, the idea of a donut, is also the whole. And without the whole, it will be probably what we'll call sufganiya in Israel. Right? If it would have an H shape, you'll call it begale. If it'll have whatever, you'll call it a pita, if it was round and made of... The part of the donutus, the part of the donut, is the part of the essence of a donut, is also the whole, which I'm going to bring into the discussion. Now, why is that? Why am I saying that?
You said also, but it's not also, but it is the essence.
Well, now you can come and say, but Zohar, you know what, let me wait with this because I'm going to take the donut a step further. You're going to be very hungry by the time we end this session. But I'm going to take it a step further. You asked me, wait a second, what about good? And the reason I'm saying this is the following. If I said that the hole and the round shape of the donut are part and parcel of the donutism, I can still say that the hole is an essential part of the donut, and you merely mark your boundaries around it by putting the dough and the flour and the thing, and now the donut can be appreciated. All right? In other words, the whole of the donut... Yeah, the whole of the donut is actually primordial to the rest of the donut. And you merely mark it around it. It's not that you brought this and I brought the whole. You marked my whole with your dough and flour. Then together we created a donut. Now why am I saying that? I'm saying that because one of the things we learn here, that now we look at the word ra. I'm saying it in the Hebrew because evil, bad. Is the question of, wait a second, is it possible that what we can learn from the conceptual flow of what we've read so far is that good is existential, whereas bad is potential. And that the potentiality of bad is an inherent component of a very good world. Yes. In other words, again, if I created a world that is only very good without an option of bad, it wouldn't be a very good world. Why? Why? Can somebody take us to the next step?
Because there's no balance to it. There's no way to measure it.
More. I want to push you even more. What you're telling me now is right, but it's because? There you go. Bingo.
Somebody wants to...
Of course, because angels don't have free will. And you can... No. If you look at the book of Job, Satan has to be bad. But he has no choice in the matter. That's why he holds no responsibility in the matter either. We'll talk about it on my third lecture when we talk about the perils of our Holocaust narrative. When we'll talk about that issue exactly. So let me reiterate this, because if we don't jump through that one, we cannot continue. The fact that each and every one of you can sit here and say life sucks is still good. Because you exist to complain. You are here to say that life sucks.
I complain, therefore I am.
No, no, no. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, existence in and of itself. The act of creation in and of itself is existentially good. In other words, the value of existence is good without the value of the content of existence, which is life itself. In other words, it doesn't matter what happens to you in life, but the fact that you are alive is already good.
Therefore, we're saying that Adam had to eat the apple.
Oh,
Therefore, we say that Adam had to eat the apple, yeah.
Yeah.
Why?
Because before that, he had no thought.
Yeah.
The apple was good.
Yeah.
Now, given the free will,
yeah,
we have to have something happen to him.
Okay.
Something happened was...
Okay.
Eating the fig, the fruit.
Yeah, well... I'll take another route. Because I'll come and say that had Adam not have free will, eating the apple, well, let's say apple now, eating the fruit would bear no consequences, or he would have no responsibility for eating the fruit. So I want to change what you said. What you said is much more deterministic in nature. What I'm saying is much more voluntaristic in nature, and it is at the very backbone of Jewish thought about this issue of good, bad, and evil. I'll say it again. It is the ability to have a choice, which this tree gives Adam and Eve, which allows the potential of evil to actualize in the world. Now, God tells them, do not eat the tree. Now you could ask as a philosopher, wait a second, wouldn't it be easier not to create the tree and thus avoid the problem? But then you misunderstand the point. I would tell you even more than that. It may sound to you, whoa. God had no choice but to put that tree in. Because had God not put the tree, and by the way, the etza da'at tovara, which is translated in Hebrew, in English, into the etza knowledge of good, I do not subscribe to this translation. I call it the tree of differentiation between good and evil, and I'll explain to you later why. It's not knowledge of good and evil. It's the ability to differentiate between good and evil. And the reason I'm saying that is just like the differentiation between light and darkness in the Genesis story. Vayavdel Elohim ben Aor. In other words, you differentiate between two elements which come from the same source, and we'll talk about it in a minute. In other words, creation is good. Creation is good. Part of that good creation is man, and I'm human. The human ability as an inherent property to have free will, and as such, to allow a landscape for the human to apply his or her free will and to bear the consequences for their choice. I'll just wrap it up. In other words, the tree of differentiation between good and evil is an inherent component of a very good world. However, as long as it is not eaten, bad remains as a potentiality. It remains as an existential potentiality. Once you make a choice to actualize that potentiality, you now move to the realm of evil. Because you made a choice. There is no existential evil in Jewish thought. There is man-made evil. There is existential bad. But that existential bad is on the level of a fruit. Yeah, I'm metaphorically, because I'm recorded here, so I'm doing this. Metaphorically, it's on the level of potentiality awaiting activation.
So how does the book of Job come to be in Jewish
Oh, fantastically well, actually. You know what? I'll return to Job in a minute, although I'm going to return to it in much more detail in the third lecture. But it's a valid question. We'll see. Okay? So what we have a very good world. Part and parcel of that very good world is the creation of Adam in the image of God, thus rendering Adam inherently as a creature with free will. And in order to activate free will, one must have a choice. And a choice, by definition, requires at least two elements which can be differentiated from one another. Now, more than that, why do you think does God say to Adam, now we just saw there's no choice but to present him the possibility of choosing. That's there. It's part of the tree. It's part of the garden. Why does God tell Adam, do not eat from that tree? Why not let them eat from the tree? It's getting a bit more... Look at the verse, actually. It's not a trick question. I mean, what does God say to Adam? The day you shall eat from the tree, you shall surely die. Right? Right? Okay, guys. Now let me ask you a question. We're all humans. We call ourselves, for whatever reason, mortals. But let me ask you a very, very simple question. Has anyone here experienced death? I assume, and I don't want to get into this because I don't want to awake all kinds, but I assume that some of you have experienced death of loved ones, or I don't want to touch this, but we live among other people, right? However, has any of you experienced death?
Even personally.
Has any of you experienced death?
No.
No, right? It seems like an idiotic question, right? Has any of you heard a dead person talking to you about death?
No?
Okay. So let me ask you a question, very simple question. What is death? And by the way, there are libraries written about this concept. And I'm asking you now, once and for all, to define that term for me.
It's the cessation of life.
How do you know?
That's what we call it.
How do you know that it's a cessation of life?
It's a cessation of life as we know it.
It's a cessation of what as we know it?
Life as we know it.
Okay, I would make a correction. It's a cessation of the appearance of life as we know it.
Okay.
There's a difference between the two. All right? So I'm going to put before you two models. One model, which is the pseudo, it's a popular belief, the pseudo-scientific, materialistic version of what death is, which calls it the cessation of life, which basically believes that life is finite by definition, right? And when the body ceases from existence as we understand it, life ends. I'm not manipulating anyone here, right? But that's pretty much that. Okay, so if we take that model and we accept it, although we have no way of knowing, let's talk about the eschatological model. That will be the second one. But first of all, let me put to rest, pun intended in this case, the first model. Okay? The first model comes and says, life is a cessation of life. Once the body ceases from existence, the person is dead. Loses consciousness, loses awareness of self. So if we accept that, when you die, and I won't say God willing, because it will happen to all of us, God forbid, because it will happen to all of us, when you die, you won't be there to say, shit, I'm dead. In other words, the very definition of death excludes your possibility of experiencing it. Because your definition of death is the lack of experience. So if this is the true model, you will not be there to know it. That's number one. We got rid of that one. Let's take the second one, which is known as the eschatological model.
You can split a hair. You can experience the moment of death, you just can't enjoy the eulogies at the funeral.
You've got the only thing humanity experiences and does it in abundance is the fear of death. And that's what I'm trying to get rid of.
No, but people experience fainting or losing consciousness and coming back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember having that experience, and seriously, when I came to, I said, this was really cool. Now I know what it's going to feel like to die, and it wasn't scary.
Well, first of all,
it wasn't, because it was an absence of feeling sick.
Right.
Which caused me to faint.
Right.
And it was very nice, because that all went away, and I came back, and I thought, okay, that was nice.
First of all, you came back.
Yes.
And second, you have no way of knowing that this experience, what you have experienced, resembles death. You have no way of experiencing.
So I want to revise what I said.
Okay.
I don't think I won't call it the cessation of life. Uh-huh. I'll call it the cessation of our ability to interact with that person in the same way.
Ah, okay. So let's put that for a second. Okay. Let me go back to the first model you understood. It basically, not basically, virtually means nothing. Not it doesn't mean anything, it means nothing. You will never get there. By your own definition, you are excluded from experiencing death in that way. The second model is eschatological. And the eschatological model comes and says, life has many appearances, many stages, manifestations is a good word, all right? And this is one of them. And you know what, guys? I'll ask you a very simple philosophical question. How do you know that this is not death?
Well, the Hindus say that we don't know.
No, how do you know this? This is death. I mean, some will say that this is hell.
The difference between sleep and life.
Hmm? Sleep. Yeah, okay. In other words, what we're doing now is we're trying to break boundaries which we take for granted. The first model is a model that I just tried to show you, is a complete delusion, has absolutely no basic on rational thought, and therefore should not be discussed anymore. It's rubbish. The second model comes and says, life has many different manifestations, and this is one of them. As one theologian once said it, our happiness lies in the moment where we understand that we are not human beings who are having a spiritual experience, but rather spiritual beings who are having a human experience. All right? So, in other words, our human experience within the body is a temporary stage. Temporary, meaning that it's part of an infinite structure. Now, to explain this infinite structure, I want to give you another metaphor. Tell me what you see. Tell me what you see. Don't analyze, tell me what you see. I'm asking this deliberately. What did I just do? I dropped a 10 and it fell on the table. Now, what do you know based on your being 21st century, blah, 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 blah?
Gravity.
We saw the law of gravity in action, right?
Also the earth moves.
Okay, we saw the law of gravity in action, right? Okay, now, if I broke this pen, could I extract the law of gravity and throw it away? So this should float around? No. If I open this table, could I extract the law of gravity out? No. Obviously, the law of gravity does not reside within the molecules of the air between the pen and the table. So now begs the question, where in God's name, and listen to the way I'm asking it, where in God's name is the law of gravity? Where is the law of gravity? The answer for which is quite simple.
The
question is tricky.
Hole.
The question is tricky. It's in the hole of the donut. And let me explain what I mean. Newton found about the law of gravity by looking at, allegedly, an apple falling from the tree, which he resembles a pen falling on the ground. It doesn't matter. Okay? And he extracted the laws of gravity that basically, according to what we believe today, govern the universe infinitely. And there are theories, by the way, today that kind of challenge that as well, but that's not the point of our discussion. Now, let's say, just for the purpose of our discussion, that the pen and the table and everything between them are the entire universe. And we are observers from outside, okay? Let's say that I now eradicated the pen altogether, vanished from existence, and eradicated the table altogether, vanished from existence. What have I done to the law of gravity?
Nothing.
Nothing. Why?
It's inherent in existence.
Yes. Let me explain. The law of gravity can only be experienced through existing particles. In this case, a pen and table. However, the law of gravity itself does not exist. It is the realm of being. I want to explain the difference. The realm of being is a level that is absolute, eternal, and has no independent manifestation in space and time, which is the world of existence. However, the world of being can only be experienced through the level of existence. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to know that it's there. Did you follow what I just say?
Yes.
Guys, don't be ashamed. If I'm babbling you, stop me and say, what the hell are you talking about?
Okay. Repeat.
Yes, if the law, the law of gravity which belongs to the realm of being, right? If there was no pen and no table, I would never know that it exists. How do I know that it exists? Only through particles that demonstrate it in existence. In this case, the pen and the table. However, if I reverse the mechanism now, and I eradicate the table, and I eradicate the pen, and all the existing particles that demonstrate the existence of the law, I don't do anything to the law. It's still there. It's there only in potentiality. Once I create two more particles, immediately it gets into action again. Right? In other words, the law of gravity is on the level of being, while the world as we know it is on the level of existing. Which leads us now to the second philosophical statement.
So you're saying good and evil?
Wait, don't go to good and evil. Wait. Trust me, it will unfold. I have a direction here. Alright? So far you follow me? Which now leads us to the following philosophical statement. Everything that exists has an origin in the being, but not everything that is must exist.
Okay.
Exist means that it is within the realm of space and time. Everything that you can conceive of within space and time. Part of it. All right. In other words, what I'm saying is that when it comes to the world of existence, everything that we experience has a realm of being that governs it. We might have not figured out all the laws of being yet. That's true. But it doesn't mean that they're there. Now you see the problems of language? I want to say it doesn't mean they don't exist, but I don't mean exist, I mean being, is. However, there could definitely be a level of being for which there is no manifestation in existence.
Space-time?
No, space-time is the manifestation of existence.
No.
Space-time is already within existence. I'm talking about everything from the Big Bang forward. To make it simpler. Everything we see is in the realm of existence. By the way, what I just said is at the very backbone of Spinoza's philosophy. There are levels that we are aware of, but that doesn't mean that there are not higher levels of being for which there is no existence and we are not aware of them at all. What I'm trying to tell you now, to your question, is that from a Jewish perspective as well, the I belongs to the realm of being, and the M belongs to the level of existing. And the fact that you can no longer communicate with the M has nothing to do with the being of the I. When I say I am, hineni, I'm already referring to two levels simultaneously, which on this existence seem to correspond in a way that is utterly enigmatic. That is utterly enigmatic. But as a matter of fact, when we look at the creation story, we see that the first thing that God does, and again, guys, I'm treating it as a story, okay? Don't turn me into some sort of a pseudo-evangelist. God actually, first and foremost, deals with the level of existence of the human, carves him out of clay, and only then inserts the being. Vayipach be'apav nishmat chayim. And God blows the breath of life into Adam's nostrils. Now I'll give you an example. What's the difference between the level of existence and the level of being in that regard? Since we just said that the level of being is infinite, one, ultimate, indivisible, simple, right? And the level of existence is what we know. So for example, if I take this pen, which is on the level of existence, and I give it to you, I gave it to Steve. Steve now has an additional pen, and I have no pen. Right? Guys, your eyes are very suspicious, as if I'm trying to tell you something. It is very strange. I'm not tricking you here. Okay? I gave the pen to Steve. Steve has an extra pen. I have no pen. If Steve gives me back the pen, I gain a pen, and Steve loses his pen. Very easy to follow. If I blow the breath of life into someone, have I lost my breath of life? No. In other words, one gains and the other does not lose. It's a completely different form of interaction. It's like lighting a candle from a candle. If you light a candle from another candle, his candle is still lit, the flame is still as vigorous as it used to be, and you have another candle, and you can light a billion candles out of the same one. A billion one, and the one did not lose. I'm not inventing this, it's written in the Zohar. The book, not me. I want you to understand this, because this distinction between level of being and existing is imperative for us to understand this. Imperative for us to understand this. When Adam alone is on the level of being, this entire question of good and evil is irrelevant. Because there's no point of reference. Like you said. I'll give you a parable. Let's say that I take you on a journey, and instead of entering Narnia, we enter a world that is entirely green. Everything is green. People are green, homes are green, cars are green. Obviously the grass is green. Everything is green. The same color, the same shade of green. Does the word green have any meaning? None whatsoever, because you have no point of reference. So if you come to someone there and say to them, wow, you're a green, then what are you talking about? Because for you, when you say you are green, you subconsciously already know what is white, what is black, what is yellow, what is red. You just don't utter it. But it is already part of the prism with which you designate a certain term. It is a construction of language in general. You do it by differentiation. His shirt is green, yours is blue. When I said blue, I said it's also not green, and vice versa, and so on and so forth.
That's why good cannot exist without bad.
Cannot
exist.
Okay. So now comes the question. On the level of existence, you must have some sort of a differentiation. All right? So part of the creation of the world in the level of existing renders it necessary to create a point of reference. But that point of reference does not need to be actualized in order for you to understand good. This is why God says, it is here, it has to be here, but I still tell you, don't eat from it. Because once you do, you will fall, as it were, into a duality that will inform your life. You will appreciate good only in relationship to bad, and you will appreciate your life only in relationship to the fear of death. Albeit, none of them actually exist. In other words, my friends, the fear of death is far more potent than death itself. And as long as you don't know it, you will continue being afraid of death, which is the number 7 fear in psychology, I think, if not even higher. But death, existentially, has no meaning. You think it does. Why? Because you differentiate. Oh, wait, I cannot understand my life without good, without bad, without... See how almost automatically we say it. Read, one can challenge it. No, you can have a very good life and it will continue to be good. Could it be that the human condition is so steeped in this kind of duality and has rationalized this kind of duality for so long that we actually are afraid of entertaining the possibility of a goodness that has no evil antagonist. Could it be that the human condition is far more scared of being truly happy than of being miserable? Because with the latter it can cope. With the former it has no tools whatsoever. No. We're saying that Adam always had immortality. Nothing changed. What changed was his perception of immortality. Look, if you think you're going to die, and you think that death is something blah, 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 and you're afraid of it, I'm just saying, and you're afraid of death and you deal with it, and you know what it is, and you know, you're forgetting that it actually affects your present. In other words, you're screwing your life now over something which you have absolutely no idea of, and which you are never going to experience anyway. You're never going to experience death. Guys, what I'm suggesting to you is to get rid of that term altogether. It's a nonsense. Yet it governs our lives. People talk about death all the time. It makes millions in the box offices. People are crazy about death.
Well, that's true of every anxiety.
Hmm?
It's true of many anxieties.
Yes.
People anticipate things that might very well not happen.
Ah.
And they spend a lot of time on that.
So what's
and a lot of money on drugs.
So the question I'm asking is it possible to puke that fruit, as it were, in order to get rid of the anxiety to begin with? Because the anxiety is already an outcome of something. It's not the root of it.
Let's say I think I've got another 10, 15 years to live.
God willing, even more.
And therefore, I want to do this, this, and this before I die.
Mm-hmm.
Without the knowledge of death,
yeah.
Would we do anything?
Excellent question. And in my opinion, absolutely yes. And I'll tell you why. Because the fact that I'm telling you you're not, you are not going to die, does not mean that you can still manifest yourself in the same way that you were here.
Not with the same intensity.
I don't know. So, by all means, go do your thing and continue doing other things.
For eternity, so I don't have to finish
anything. No, you don't have to finish anything, but you don't know what happens in that eternity. You don't know whether you're capable of continuing what you've done, whether you remember yourself in that. I mean, it's an irrelevant question for me. What is relevant for me, and I'm trying to bring you all the time, as it were, really, down to earth. Because in order to come down to earth, as it were, you need to fly very, very high and then revisit what you have taken for granted. And one of the things that is important for me to break here right from the get-go, and I know that it's kind of heavy, is first of all get rid of the term death, in order for us to be able to revisit the term bad. Okay? Was that okay? Okay. So now what I suggest, it's now 5 to 8. Let's take a 5-minute break, 10-minute break. How much do we usually take? Oh, we're good. Take your time. Okay, friends. Any questions up to now? What?
Can we start from the beginning?
You say, aside of everything, I have no question. Any? Don't be shy, my friends. Yeah. Yeah. And I haven't forgotten your Job's question either, so I'll return to it.
Why God created the world, and the answer is to give it Torah, right? Or is that
one of the questions? Yeah.
Okay. That whole thing is meaningless unless God wanted Adam to eat from the tree of life.
Okay. There is a midrash. You know, there's a solution to everything. Once you're set to find it, especially on midrashic literature. So there is a midrash that says that when Adam was in the Garden of Eden, Adam was a being of light.
A being of light?
A being. Speaking of being, right? Versus existence. He was a being of light. And the Torah was also a Torah of light. And Adam knew the entire goodness, the existential goodness of being, without needing any point of reference. He just basked in the glow of God. And if you think about Adam being a being of light himself, or him, her, itself, then it kind of, what does it mean to bask in the glow of God? If you are yourself a light, there's no much differentiation there between Adam and God to begin with. It says that after Adam and Eve had eaten from the fruit, and now they make a very interesting interpretation, they look at the verse, and God made them garments of skin and clothed them, which we usually think of a Neanderthal kind of garment, right, that you put around their and they understand it to be this. The body is a garment of skin. In other words, they came into existence. I think I told you that, some of you, once. This is, by the way, one of the reasons, according to Jewish Kabbalists, that when you do Havdalah, when you bless over the Havdalah and you hold your hands to the candle, you hold it in a such a way that the candles are reflected in your nails. Anybody remembers why? The nails. Because the Kabbalists perceive the nail as petrified light. It's the last remnant of the being of light which is now covered with skin. They don't see the nail as an addition to the skin, but rather they see the skin as an addition to the nail. You understand what I just say? So in the Buddha there, they say to reverse the whole reverse the situation, so you observe the light of the candle into the being of light, and one day we will become light again. So the reason I'm saying this to you is because for the rabbis, there is also an answer about the God creating the world in order to give Torah, but He had already given Torah to Adam. It was just once Adam had descended to the level of a human, so has the Torah descended to earth through Sinai, in His footsteps. So the Torah in Sinai is actually, from this Midrash, some sort of a compromise.
It was in being and then it became into existence.
Exactly. And by the way, they go even further. They say, just as man has enclosed himself in skin, so has Torah. This is why it has to be on a skin parchment. So it goes and goes and goes and goes and goes. All right, so just to answer your point. Any other questions, by the way, before...
Just keep telling us.
Oh, okay. Any, you?
If I'm the Zee, if you were the author of this story...
Yeah.
2,500 years ago...
Yeah.
Why would you pick a tree?
It's a symbol, it's a natural symbolism, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you're opening a huge question here. So I'll answer it very, very briefly. And if you want, you can come to me later. I'll give you more bibliography to go with, because it's an interesting question. To understand your question, you first of all need to understand the structure, the etymological structure of the Hebrew language. And the etymological structure of the Hebrew language, how do you say, well, I'm going to answer it, and I'm going to answer it by asking it. What is the etymological founding block of a Hebrew word? What is it called in Hebrew? Shoresh, which is
a root.
The perception of, and that's an entirely different topic, but the perception of Torah in classical Jewish discourse is that of a divinity cloaked in language. In other words, a divine that is perceived through the lingual form. Words are perceived not as a mode of communication, but rather as a mode of divine manifestation. Okay? Now, just as I spoke to you about the transition.
Is that why the Goyim say, in the beginning it was the Word?
Well, that's one of the reasons why you are referring to the first chapter in the book of John. In the beginning there was God, and God was with the Word, and the Word was with God, blah, 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 blah. The reason it is there is because those who wrote it were Jewish. Absolutely. The whole world. What I'm trying to tell you is that the perception of the transition from God as a level of being to the world as a level of existence is that of the actualization of potentiality. In other words, I'll give you an analysis. When you see a tree, you ask me about the tree, right? When you see a tree around, where you go out and you see a tree, right? What was that tree before it became a tree? And before it was a seedling? Or what was it?
Seed.
A seed. Where was the seed? Where was it? Inside the earth, right? So when it was a seed, you could go past it without even knowing that it's there. Now, the tree in its fullest, and it could be a 300-foot tree, like a sequoia, right, is merely nothing more than the actualization of the seed. In other words, the full potential of all these 300 feet were already existed as potential in the seed, completely beyond your sight. Okay? Now, the seed, by definition, is far simpler, far smaller, right? Far less complicated than its manifestation. Right? Now think about it now, to help you work with this. Think about the entire cosmic structure from this standpoint. It's a tree whose root or whose seed is in heaven and whose branches are the cosmos, are the universe. An upside down tree, as it were. Okay? And now basically what people try to do all the time through the Torah is basically to sift through the branches and the leaves and the fruits and blah, 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 in order to get from the more differentiated into the more unified. From the branches to the thicker branches. From the thicker branches to the trunk. From the trunk to the roots. From the roots to the seed. At which point they can understand the fuller gamut of the divine trajectory. One of the examples to give you that, and I think I mentioned it to some of you before, is the word emet in Hebrew. Have you ever thought about that word? Emet means
truth,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the Torah, we know that it says, Adonai Eloichem emet. Lord your God is emet. But it's not only understood as emet truth, which is the philological rendition or the translation of the word. Emet is also the first letter of the alphabet, the middle letter of the alphabet, and the last letter of the alphabet. In other words, the word emet is the seed of the entire Hebrew language. It's just the seed. The entire Hebrew language sprung from that word, because no matter what word you now concoct in Hebrew, it's from A to Z. The same thing is the rabbi's understanding of the so-called least significant word in the Genesis story. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. Right? If I asked you to translate that, you say in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. But the word the here, et, is for those rabbis the most significant word in the entire verse, because they read it, in the beginning God created the earth from A to Z, Aleph Ataf, et, and the heavens, Aleph Ataf, et. And now let's start talking. You understand? In other words, the notion of a movement from seed to trunk to root to branch is deeply, deeply seated in the understanding of the linguistic manifestation of the divine in the Torah. That's why a tree makes so much sense here. But that's just to give you a taste. If you're interested in exploring this more, I'll be happy to help you. If you're interested in this, the myth and the mythological structure of a tree. All right. Any other questions?
Etz Chaim
Mila Machzikim Ba Vetom Chaim Meushal. There are many, many, many examples. Yeah, many, many examples. I can also take you to some historical reasons and landscape reasons. Don't forget that the Torah was written by a generation of desert dwellers for whom tree is something that is very dramatically in opposition to their immediate landscape. It is the hub of life. It is the consummation of fertility. So there are many, many psychological reasons as well. So you can. It goes on and on and on, but I don't want to take away from where we are. Any other questions about what we talked about? All right, so let's now continue to deal with this problematic question of good, bad, and evil. I'm going to tell you a sentence now, which is going to be the opening sentence of my third lecture. And that is that the monotheistic constitution of Judaism cannot afford the pretext of an autonomous antagonism or an autonomous antagonist to God. In other words, Judaism, unlike Christianity and other theological structures, has no autonomous agent of malevolence. It does not exist. Devil doesn't exist in Judaism, and even Satan and other malevolent agents who've been the product of rabbis and others, and there's a whole historical reason for that, they are always subject to the divine decree. They have no free will. They do what God says. That's why in rabbinical dictum there is a special blessing that is called the blessing for evil tidings. That says the following thing. Adam chayav levarech al hatova kashem shehu chayav levarech al hara'a. A person must bless God for the good things that happens to him or her, just as he or she must bless God for the bad things that happen to them. In other words, it's as if God tells you, I am the awesome, I am also the awful. I am that I am. Kaddish only glorifies God. Don't forget that Kaddish glorifies God because Kaddish doesn't recognize the truth of death. That's what we already talked about. But the idea here now is to understand that if you are serious about your understanding of monotheism, you have a major ethical challenge ahead of you. Because to be quite honest, it's much easier for a dualistic state of mind to deal with good and evil. You just push it all on Satan and say, pardon my language, fuck you. Jews have to look at God for that.
The devil made me do it. No?
Which now takes me to your previous question about Job. And if you look at Job, at the book of Job, which is a fantastic example, you see, God brings around him an assembly of angels. Ubeinehem, and amongst them, Satan. Okay? And God says to his angels, and you can check me out, we all have the same version. He says, look at my servant Job, who is my birth servant, he's the most righteous, unlike any other in this vast land. And all the angels say, go Job. And Satan, what does Satan do? Says to God, well, of course, you gave him, I don't know, 5 wives and 7 daughters and 7 sons, and he has a Porsche, and he has a great 401k, and he's a pension and out the wazoo. He's happy. Of course, what do you want him to curse you? Of course he's going to bless you. Everything that happened to him is good. So God says, okay, I'm intrigued. What do you suggest? Now, here's something interesting to understand. Satan has no choice but to be Satan. Angels are beings who are committed to their own raison d'être. In other words, Satan has no choice but to be Satan. It's not that he looked at Job and said, you know what, I'm going to have a choice, I'm going to screw with this guy. No. That's what he does. He screws with people's lives. That's what he knows to do. That's what he was created to do. So he comes to God and he says, okay, let me inflict some pain on his flesh. Let me do this, do that. Let's see if he praises you and says, look at God and I love God. Do you remember what's God's reply? You may touch his flesh, but don't lay a finger on his soul. And what does Satan do? Exactly what God does. Satan has no choice in the matter whatsoever. This is why when you read the book of Job, with all of his friends, Eliphaz the Temani and Bildad the Shuhi, all of them, none of them talks about Satan. You won't see the word once mentioned by any of them. They all talk about God. This one argues with him, but he talks about God. I don't understand why God gave me birth, and I wish God brought me back to my mother's womb, and then made me curse the day that I was born. He doesn't talk about Satan. He doesn't look at Satan and say, why have you done this? He talks about God. Because the Jew must accept God as the one who has done this. Now let's look at some of the verses here. And now you'll understand the hole in the donut. Look at Isaiah 45. If you didn't believe me, hear it from the big kahunas. That they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none beside me. I am the Lord and there is none else. Okay? And now it continues. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create bad. I'm using the word bad here. I am the Lord that does all these things. If you had any doubts, here it is, black on scroll. Now guys, please explain to me something that is very puzzling here. Because we were brought to believe somehow, for some reason, that darkness is the absence of light. So why doesn't God say, I create light, or I make light, or whatever, I create light, and I shut off light? Why does it have to say, I create light, or I form the light, and create darkness? Well, in the beginning, everything was darkness, if you want to be accurate. And God said, let there be light. Right? The what? Is darkness the opposite of light? In your opinion? I'm asking. Okay. Anybody wants to suggest something else?
Creates the darkness, the light. Okay, but the darkness creates when the light moves. In other words, it's not the change in the galaxy.
Okay. Anything else?
With light, you see the darkness. Darkness is always there.
Do you equate darkness with bad?
No.
Hmm? Do you think that was the intent of the verse? No, it equates light with peace. Look at the formation of the sentence. You have a resha and a seifa. The resha is light and then peace, and then the seifa is darkness and then evil.
But you know, you need darkness sometimes. If you're a plant, you need it to grow. You need times of dark. You need time to go inward, to develop.
Mm-hmm. More?
To rest.
To?
Rest.
Rest.
To sleep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You see, my friends, the problem is that you think about light and darkness not just in 21st century terms. Conceptually, you conceive of them as one or the other. So let me make your life a little bit more sophisticated. Let's say that you're sitting on the moon and you're watching the sun. Okay? And you're watching the sun in space. And you see the light of the sun. But then when you look around from the sun, away from the sun, you see darkness of space. Where does the light of the sun end and the darkness of space begin? If they're opposites. The reason I'm asking it this way is because, in fact, we should not look at these things as necessarily opposites. The term opposite is yet another delusion that is highly dangerous to the rational mind. Because the term opposite assumes that in order for Y to be the opposite of X, every element of X must not exist in Y. However, that's not how it works. Light and darkness have a lot in common. If you say that darkness and light are opposites, I can tell you that so are oranges and bananas. But you will say, wait, no. These are two different types of the same category that is called fruit. And I will tell you that light and darkness are the same manifestations or different manifestations of the same category called being. They are not necessarily opposite. I'll give you an example. If you hurt your finger on a thorn, or let's say you fell on a rose bush, and you're in pain, right? Is the rose bad? Are the thorns bad? Did something bad happen to you? Why? Because?
Got hurt.
Excellent. It hurt. And by doing so, it taught you a great lesson which saved you from being hurt a zillion more times throughout your lifetime. Now let me reiterate the question. Was the thorn bad? Was the rose bad? Was what happened to you bad?
Yeah.
It depends on the context, guys.
If
you are singed by a fire, which prevents you from entering your entire body into it, is the singeing bad? What I'm trying to show you here is that the definition here depends on context. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example of context, because context is probably one of the most important things to also understand ethical questions. I'm going to give you a sentence, tell me who said it. Or, you know what, let me rephrase. All Jews must leave their home countries and go to Palestine. Sentence. All right? Is this sentence Zionistic or anti-Semitic?
Why?
Two people said almost the same sentence, by the way. One of them is Ben Gurion. And a little bit earlier than he did, it was Gables. Gables, the propaganda officer of the Nazi regime. All Jews must leave there and go to Palestine. Why not a Zionist? Context. In other words... What? Okay, so the reason I'm saying this now is because we need to ask ourselves the following question. Is bad objective or subjective? It's a question. I'm not presumptuous enough to answer. But it is a valid question. In other words, because we've already established that good is objective. If you exist, it is already good. Your life can suck. But you are there to say it, that it's not good. So there's always hope for you. Bad is a completely different question, because bad is potential. So now the question is thus, on two ways. One, do bad things happen to you? Or do you perceive certain things as bad? That's one question. And two, have you ever done... Now look what I just said. do bad things happen to you? Have you ever done evil without having a choice in the matter? I want to explain that.
Two questions. In Pirkei Avot, the ethics of the fathers, Rabbi Akiva says the following sentence, which will send the Jewish world into a roller coaster, theological, philosophical roller coaster. And that is, הכל צפוי והרשות נתונה. Anyone wants to translate? All is predicted. Everything is predicted by God. Yet
you still have free will.
Yet you still have free will. How is that possible? If everything is predicted, how do I have free will? If I know, if God knew in advance that you're going to sit here today and listen to me mumbling, how is it your free will? Now guys, you have to understand, if we reverse engineer this, the ramifications on good and evil and bad are profound. Because if man has no free will whatsoever, men should not be held accountable for anything, and I'll be blunt, including Hitler. How do you reconcile tzafui, predicted, perceived, seen, v'arashut netona? So I would like to offer you one model.
Can't you translate that tzafui as expected also?
The two?
As expected. Mm-hmm.
Ah. I would translate it into...
Because that's different than the term.
I would translate it as possible. Mm-hmm. Let me explain. Let's say that this is man. Let's say that this is God. And God knows everything. In a minute we'll see that that's not true either. But God is...
Could we also known? Could we also use the word always known?
All is known, absolutely. That's another word that can be used here. All is known, and there is free will. And free will is granted. Half. If God knows from the moment of your birth, as it were, I'm simplifying this, all the possible path that you may take in your life, infinite in number, all of them, in advance, all the possible path that has nothing to do with the actual path that you will ultimately take. In other words, the fact that God knows in advance all the possible tracks that you can take in life does not take anything from your own authority over the actual path that you will take. In other words, God's knowledge is in the realm of potential, whereas your life is in the realm of actual. So if you eventually decided to lead a life that goes this way, until you depart this world, you ultimately chose a path that is already known by God, because any path will be known by God. What God doesn't know and doesn't take responsibility for is what's the actual path you're going to take.
Why not?
Because then it's not your own free will. This path is your free will. You could have walked this way, you could have walked this way, you could have changed this path, you could have... In other words, free will, the distance between God's foreknowledge, which is in the realm of potential, and man's actual decision, which is in the realm of actual, is life in Jewish thought, is the realm of life, is the landscape of life. This is why Judaism, if you look at the prophets, if you look at the sages, if you look at the kings, if you look at the rabbis, they don't deal too much with what God knows. God knows everything. What they deal with is what you chose. That's. What you repent about in Yom Kippur is this. Right here. Not all of that. Just this, what you're thinking. Because it is the realm of choice which brings with it the realm of accountability and responsibility. I just wanna. Now the reason God says in Isaiah, and I'll show you that in Deuteronomy as well, that God says in Isaiah, I have created darkness, I have created bad, is not to show you that he is omnipotent. It's not to further complicate life. It's to actually put the onus on you to make a conscious choice of what path to take in life. I created it. It is here in the realm of potential. Now you decide whether you're going to eat the fruit or not eat the fruit. And by the way, guys, the story of the Garden of Eden is a story that happens to each and every one of us 1,000 times a day. That's what I want you to take from this lesson. It's not one epic moment that happened in a garden, but rather it is a repetitive moment that happens in the garden that is called your soul every day. Do I eat the fruit? Do I not eat the fruit? It's called choice. So now I want us to look for a second at Deuteronomy to understand what I just said. Here is Deuteronomy 30, which is almost the very end of the Torah. And by the way, I advise you to look at the Torah not as the five books of Moses, but rather as 4 plus 1. Because if you actually read the Torah, you see that there is an evolution of 4 books. And then the 5th book actually looks back, and Moses speaks to the Israelites and reminds them of the whole 4 books. Before he dies and they're about to enter the land under the leadership of Joshua. So the 5th book is in many ways the most important work because it's a summary of all the major lessons we learned. And look what happens towards the very end of the Torah. And it shall come to pass when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse. Now look what God says here. Which I have set before thee. And thou shalt bethink thyself among all the nations, blah, 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 blah. And now look at verse 15. See, I have set before thee this day life and good, death and evil. Anybody remembers how
therefore,
this...
Therefore, choose
life. And from the verse, we can see that the designation of life equals choose good. I've set before you good and life. Bad and death, choose life. Ubacharta b'chaim. My friends, that's not a commandment. It's a recommendation of God. Because you have the choice to ignore it. Mm-hmm. And this is something to understand as at the very core of Torah. In general. The Torah ultimately says 2 major things. I'm not talking about the content, I'm talking about the approach. It says, basically, you can do, as a human, created in the image of God, you can do whatever you want. You can kill, you can maim, you can cheat, you can lie, you can rape, you can steal, you can covet, you can manipulate, you can do everything, you are that great. Don't. That's basically the Torah. You can do anything you want, don't. God cannot stop you. No lightning from heaven. God cannot stop you. Not because God cannot, because he's weak. That's what most people don't understand. It's not. It's because your raison d'être, you were created with the free will. God is not interested in stopping you. This is why when people ask all the time, where was God during the Holocaust? The first question I ask them is, where was man during the Holocaust? God was just there. Some parts of God destroying other parts of God because they made a choice. What did you expect? It doesn't work any other way. But the notion here is, please understand that I've given you the ability to choose, and now where it gets really fantastic, you have absolutely no choice but to choose. In other words, when we talk about the human as created inherently as a choosing entity, we're actually talking about a human who was created with no choice whatsoever but to choose. You follow what I just say? You cannot not choose.
So then, what was the point at the very beginning of God telling him not to eat from that tree? When it's obvious that the only way he could realize or actualize his potential, the only way he could really be B'Tselem Elohim, was precisely to eat that fruit and to make those choices. So why did he bother telling him not to eat? What game was he playing there?
Maybe to activate the property of choice. But also, and that's the second point I wanted to make, it is to re-enlist or introduce the property of accountability. And let me explain this as well. We think in linear forms. We think in terms in terms of cause and effect. Many of us are still prisoners of the semi-infantile perception of you do good, you get a reward. You do bad, you get a punishment. That's not the structure of the Jewish theological constitution. If you actually read the way the Torah or the way God enters into discourse with the Hebrews and then with many of their representatives, either prophets or kings, there's a very different mechanism there. You are so bound to the divine by being created in the image of God that when you do good, the actual act of goodness is the reward itself. In other words, by activating goodness, you're affecting the world around you and affecting yourself in turn. And the actual punishment for bad is the bad itself. That's why when people say, how is it that you have tzaddik veralo, a righteous person who feels bad, who is agonizing, and an evil person who feels happy and merry and joy? My answer to this, I haven't yet seen, and I'm serious, I haven't yet met an evil person who is happy. The reason I'm saying this is because neither I nor you know what goes on in their mind. I'm not impressed by a Porsche or a BMW or a lot of money in the bank. That's not where you're measured. You have to understand, that's why I asked you, did you ever commit evil when you did not have a choice? And the answer to which is never. You always have a choice. And if somebody chooses to do evil, that means that something goes on here that is corrupt. And that's the punishment. That's already the punishment. That's what I want you to understand. In other words,
in a way, the punishment precedes the act.
The very fact that you perceive the world in such a way that leads you to act in an evil way is already a punishment in and of itself.
Just to understand, so basically what you're saying is that Adam was, everything that changed before he ate the apple was his deception.
Precisely. You got it brilliantly. Exactly. Nothing changed and everything changed. Nothing changed in Adam's reality. Just his perception. And in perception, guys, when we talk about perception, now we're entering into a remarkable world.
So why did there need to be an action?
Mm-hmm.
Why did you need an action in order for the perception to change? If this was all inside of him, why did he need the act itself?
Well, I think, first of all, don't forget that the story is told in such a manner so people can read it. You cannot merely, I mean, for us to be able to discuss this story and deal with it on the level that we're dealing with it now, we have to deal, unfortunately, but that's the way we are as humans, we have to deal with external things. That's part of religion as well. Why do so many people treat God as if God is truly different than them? Until today, most people, when they talk about God, They conceptually perceive God as something that is separate from them. And that's not the situation at all, according to what I'm trying to tell you. What I'm trying to tell you is that... I'm trying to tell you, do not read the first verse of Genesis, Bereshit bara Elohim tashamayim v'taaretz, as if it translates into, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, but rather read it, the heavens and the earth are God in creation. In other words, that now the human is first of all part of God, an extension of divinity, that can now activate that divine potential throughout its life. And at the same time, we are that part of God which still does not understand the fullest ramifications of what I just said. We still see a barrier between us and God. We still try to establish a relationship with God. And in order to establish a relationship with anything, there needs to be a distinction between one and the other. And I come and say something different. There is no real distinction between you and God. The story is now told to those who perceive in dualistic terms. Good versus bad, life versus death, and also man versus God. I think that once you reverse that mechanism, as it were, going back to the Garden of Eden, as it were, puking that fruit, as it were, you're actually getting rid of certain key terms that made you believe in your life that there is actual difference between one and the other. And then you are coming to a more unified sense, a more unified understanding of who you are. I think that the story is told for people who are already reading the story from a dualistic perspective. That's why it has to become tangible. I think that once you pass that barrier, you're right, all of it can become the internal landscape of perception rather than walking in a garden and eating a fruit and dealing with a tree and so on and so forth. Yeah, I saw another. Yeah.
Is that some of what you just said?
Of course. To be a partner in the act of creation, of course. And it's not just a partner. It's more than a partner. Arthur Green, the theologian Arthur Green, once put it very beautifully. He said there's an article called Speaking in Thunder, and he said it there. He said, "The only God I know is a divinity that cannot be experienced in this world at all except through human actions." In other words, you are talking about a human condition whose intimacy with the divine is far more radical than you believe. It's not in your face. The eyes, your eyes that are asking, where is God, are already part of God looking for itself. As one theologian once put it, humans are that part of God which tries to understand all of God. We are in search of something, not necessarily understanding or fully aware of the fact that the force that is searching is already part of what the quest is. That's why another day is search for yourself and you'll find God. It's not a cliche. So now, guys, I want us to go to the last verse. Before we wrap this up, that's on the second page, on the back page. And that is something that God says after God brings the flood on the generation of Noah. And I always found this verse very, very interesting. Because it says something that also sent scores of theologians and philosophers and thinkers about what does God mean in that. And the Lord smelled the sweet savor that Noah and his sons are giving God after the flood. And the Lord said in his heart, "I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake." Why? "For the inclination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite anymore everything living as I have done." What do you understand from this verse about God's perception of the human, of the human condition? And that goes to your earlier question about good and evil in the beginning of the lesson.
What do you understand God says here? How do you interpret this verse? And by the way, I understand the word evil as bad, not evil, bad, based on the distinction we made.
He is what he is, and we are what we are.
So you are saying the inclination of a man's heart is bad from his youth. That's who he is. Is that an inherent property in your mind?
It's inherent potentiality. That's what free will is.
Yeah. What do you make here? Why doesn't God say the inclination of a man's heart is evil from his birth? Why from his youth? Why, if it's inherent, why from his conception? Why from his youth?
Man has to learn to be evil.
Nurture versus nature. Precisely. Evil is a learned property, not an inherent one. The inclination may be there. Its actualization, the belief in its power, in its advantage, in its existence as a necessary property on earth, as so many people believe, is something of our own device that we learn about and we start entertaining here as from our youth, as it were. Youth is already, you're well entrenched in history, you're well entrenched in this world. You've already learned a thing or two. You now believe that evil, or your inclination towards evil, is already well established. God says nothing about evil being a necessary property for existing.
But you're not saying anything about culture.
I didn't use the word societies and fashion and many, many other things. I did allude to that, I thought, when I talked about the difference between bad or evil as an event and bad or evil as a perception. And the perception, of course, is managed also by culture, by historical context.
Yes, it just stays vague when
here in this verse?
Yeah.
Here in this verse, he comes and says, people have introduced the reality of evil as part of life, as a necessary part of life. Today when you ask most people, they will tell you, look, there's nothing you can do. Evil is... Shit happens! This is the way it is. There's nothing you can do about it. And I'm saying no.
Well, one thing that's always puzzled me about the Noah story is that God only learns it at this point. Or only seems to learn it at this point. Mm-hmm. Like before this, he didn't know.
Yeah, what happened to Akol Tzafui?
Exactly. God learns it because of men's choices. Yes.
God also evolved.
But he knew that was a possible choice.
It's a possible choice, and he regrets.
So why does he only know it now?
No, he regrets the fact that one of the possible choices that sucks was chosen by humanity. And remember what we said earlier to your question. Bad has to exist as a potentiality. Otherwise, there's no point of having a free will. So God cannot blame men for having an inclination of evil. God can only blame men for having actualized that inclination.
But you're also saying that man can be without evil.
Yeah, of course.
No.
Mm-hmm. Why? You have to.
Evil in all of us. There's potential evil.
That's right. I said that all along.
Yeah,
the question is, do you have to exist? Do you, as part of your life,
have to commit evil?
Do you have to?
No, you choose.
You choose.
Yeah.
You choose. And by the way, I want to break another myth. Because a lot of people say, wait, there's a difference between the cessation of good and the activation of evil. And I say, no, there is no such a thing. There is no cessation of good. Good is. If you do evil, Then there is a cessation of good. But there is no cessation of good without evil.
But if you do evil, is there a cessation of good? The other way around, yeah.
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 Yeah. Bad is an existential potential. The tree of knowledge, the tree of differentiation between good and bad. Evil, according to my analysis, is the conscious choice to activate that potential in your life. Like she just said, we all have the inclination for bad.
We're all bad, but we
it is inherent. The inclination is inherent.
That's the bad.
If I now commit to come and hurt you, I did an evil action. Because it's a choice. There is no evil. That's why I asked you the question. Has any one of you ever done evil without having a choice in the matter?
That was a trick question.
There's something missing here.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you haven't come.
That?
You have not come.
Yeah.
Which I think is important.
Yeah.
Punishment. Especially the biblical view happened to maybe the 20th century.
Again, it depends on how you read it. And of course, I'm not suggesting that my way of looking at it is the only way. Of course not. What I'm trying to say here is that the kind of linear perception of good leads to reward, bad leads to punishment is erroneous, or at the very least, simplistic.
Deeds, this is why we were punished, and so forth.
Again, we're punished, meaning what? That God, an external God, punished us? Or that our deeds led to this trajectory?
Our deeds led to this trajectory.
Ah, so actually, because of our deeds, we punished ourselves.
But I agree with you.
Yeah.
But in most of Judaic thinking, mm-hmm. I don't know if they differentiate.
Oh, no, the same answer I gave her.
Okay.
The rendition is very, very simplistic. Look, the way it is portrayed is very simplistic, much, much more simplistic than what I'm giving you.
Which I can't believe that the rabbis did not differentiate
on this. Oh, no, they have. They just don't necessarily talk about it in popular discourse. But if you actually read Hasidic discourse on matters of, for example, Galut, exile, Hasidic discourse about the Holocaust, other elements that try to deal with divine so-called punishment, and they say, "Mipnei chataenu galenu me'artzenu," because of our sins we were exiled. They don't come and say, God now knocks on our heads. It is, our misdemeanor led us to go astray. Our misdemeanor led us to go on this trajectory. Our misdemeanor is the seed of the punishment. And the punishment itself in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, is the actual tree, as it were. The actual actualization of that seed, which we have planted. We have planted it.
Could you say, given what you say, God is absolute in this metaphor. But even an absolute being can still learn and evolve. So doesn't that answer this question about why did God do things in the first place? I mean, he learns from things.
The term evolution here is again problematic because in the human mind, evolution suggests something greater than what was there before. Well, I'm looking at it differently. I'm saying that God is absolute in potentiality, and that the evolution of God within this infinite potentiality is at the hands of men. And that we don't cease from surprising God every moment of our lives because of our choices. I don't think that God is bored for a single second, because God is surprised and sometimes bewildered and sometimes rejoices and sometimes happy about our choices. Well, I think it's a very cynical sense of humor sometimes when I look at some of the people he had created, but that's a different issue.
Yeah, but in this instance, he admits to having made a mistake.
Why? Why made a mistake?
He's making a choice.
No. He changes his mind. He says, first of all, there's a lesson of personal responsibility. We make the choices and we bear the consequences. God made us in that way.
Mm-hmm.
He has to bear the consequences.
Absolutely.
And getting pissed off at what the human race has done to the earth, as he comes to realize, is not an acceptable choice. What the hell did he expect? What did he want when he made man B'Tselmo? And therefore his, as it's portrayed at least simplistically, his anger, whatever that means,
right,
and destruction of the earth through the flood, was not legitimate, as he himself pronounces when he says he will never do it again.
Look, if God comes and says to you, look, I suggest to you that you don't do A, and if you do A, you will bear the consequences. But I cannot prevent you from doing A. But if you do A, I will hit you. And you did A, and you get hit, don't complain to God. That's number one. Number two is that what I find fascinating in this is what you said, is that the Torah does not shy away, albeit sometimes by many rabbis reluctantly, from admitting, as it were, that God also learns something about mankind as mankind evolves. In other words, God knows all of what mankind is capable of doing, but he's surprised of the actual decisions that man is doing. And those bring his wrath and then bring his anger. And then, so I agree with you. I mean, I think that to a certain degree, God should have been bigger than this, as it were. But at the same time, again,
I mean, it's a very interesting idea of the, you know, the sort of the Jewish view of the so-called omniscient God, because God created man in his image, and man continually surprises him, and God learns about man's potentiality, which means that he's learning about his own potentiality.
Absolutely. No,
so all this is very nice when we take personal responsibility and we realize what a gift we have in life. How do you account for illness or for children who have terrible illness? I mean, how do we live with that? How do we account for that?
First of all, the assumption that I have the question of bad solved is erroneous. I have still many questions that I have absolutely no resolution for. What I can tell you is that I think that there is still a great distance between what we perceive as other people's experiences and their experiences in reality. I'll give an example of autism, for example. Or even of people, God forbid, who are vegetables or in a coma or in a stage of deep comatose. People judge them, as it were. Yeah, judge them. I mean, people refer to them only based on the level of encounter or interchange they can have with them on the level that we can identify, which usually is the outer shell. And we come and say, if their brain is damaged, that means that there is absolutely no activity there, blah, blah, blah. And I say, don't confuse the author with the typewriter. The fact that the typewriter is broken does not mean that the author is not brilliant anymore. It just means that he cannot write. So don't confuse the brain with the mind.
Okay.
So I remind myself, for example, that a lot of people who have no full brain activity challenged in such a way, I make absolutely no judgment about their mental capability, about their internal dialogue with themselves or monologue, and the richness of their inner world. Because quite honestly, I have absolutely no access to that world. And for me, that's their real kingdom. The second point I'll say is,
Down syndrome person could have a richer internal world.
As far as I know, absolutely, and I have absolutely no right to judge him, again, based on his brain. Definitely not based on his looks. And we do, unfortunately. We assume that if the typewriter is damaged, then there is no real author inside. And I say there's no connection between the two.
Only a few hundred years ago, deaf people were regarded as idiots.
Yeah, no people were. The second thing is, and again, I don't want to end this because I really don't want to belittle in any shape or form anybody's own stories or tragedies, God forbid. I think that if our perception of death changed dramatically, it would also have a profound effect on our perception of suffering in this world. And again, I don't. I know that I'm entering here something that is so so.
I have a very comfortable relationship with that.
No, no, I'm talking about other people.
I have a problem when an 8-year-old child gets hit by a car and is killed.
Or cancer.
But okay, yeah, I'm with you. And again, I don't want to.
And maybe he is going to a fabulous world, and he got there, you know, express. But that's
so
really hard to digest.
Yeah, but whose pain? Again, I want to be very gentle. If an 8-year-old kid, and again, God forbid, I'm not saying that, I want to be very clear on this, especially for the ones who are listening to this. If an 8-year-old, God forbid, is hit by a car and killed, and his soul goes to another place, whose pain are we really talking about here? Okay, that's all I want us to think about for a second, because I think that in many ways, we self-project our own pain into the victim and then double the amount of pain we're dealing with instead of actually... And again, I'm not judging anyone. I'm not saying, I'm not giving critique. But what we're doing is we're doubling the amount of suffering on behalf of the person who had died without even knowing what he's going through or she's going through. And perhaps, and again, I'm just... Perhaps death, even an early death, is a great gift. Perhaps we are the ones who should lament for ourselves for staying here for so long. I don't know. All I know is that I need to do the best I can with the time allotted to me and not judge those who are staying behind me or left earlier than me. And to focus on that notion, I think, is exceedingly difficult. But I think one of the reasons it's so difficult is also because we have a very skewed perception of what death is. And I think that that's one venue of revisiting that kind of without again belittling in any way the profound pain that anybody has within it. Again, I would say it is something to say. I would not. Again, this is why I'm saying it and I'm retracting and I'm clarifying myself. I'm not belittling the sense of pain. God forbid, it's painful. The separation is painful. The fact that you cannot be, it's painful. All I'm saying is that once we try to grapple with the way we project pain and what is really ours and what is really theirs, the person who passed, we see that actually the ratio here is 100% ours, nothing theirs. And that may allow us to revisit that whole world in a different manner. Not to belittle by any means, I'm not saying, just to give a different context and maybe, God willing, get a peace of mind at a certain level. Not to accept it, not... You know, there are levels of human suffering for which I have nothing to say but to bow my head and say, at this point, I'm silent. That's it. But all I'm saying here is that a lot of our pain is not because the event is evil, but because we perceive it as such. That's all I'm saying.
Well, sure.
And
children or the young people who experience all the things that we've experienced.
Absolutely.
That's what we know to be
absolutely.
Good.
And that's good and legitimate and fine. Okay, chaverim, it's 9:10, so we're. I'll see you, God willing, if you make the choice, next week.
We heard someone say recently, "Im tirtzeh Hashem."
Im tirtzeh Hashem, yafe mod.
Kol hakavod.